Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody, and it seems that there are quite a number of people that logged in and logged out of the chat room, and I have a feeling they're going to log back in. The sun is not out, but the rain might stop, and this is Literary Viewpoints, and this is Fran Lewis, and I hope you guys are having a really great day, because this show is going to really be quite interesting. In 9:30 CE, a revered group of scholars penned the first sanctioned Bible, planting the seed from which other major religions would grow. But believe it or not, 1953, half the manuscript goes missing while being transported from Syria. Around the same time, in the foothills of the Dead Sea, an ancient scroll is discovered and promptly stolen. Six decades later, both parchments stand at the heart of a geopolitical battle between foreign governments and radical extremists threatening the lives of millions. That's plot one. Now, plot two. With the American homeland under siege, the president turns to a team of uniquely trained covert operatives, including FBI profiler, who's really great people, Karen Vale, Special Forces veteran Hector DeSantos, I like him, and FBI terrorism expert Aaron Uziel. Their mission, find the stolen documents and capture or kill those responsible for unleashing a coordinated and unprecedented attack on U.S. soil. And we have the author of this complex, really fantastic novel right here, Alan Jacobson, The Lost Codex. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Fran. I'm doing great.
I'm glad you are. <That's good. laughs> Yeah.
Well, we've got a little rain here in California, and we need it, so I'm happy.
Well, we've got plenty of rain up here in upper New York, and we're going to have it for a couple of days, and I don't want it because I really like to work outside. So, anyway, this is a very complex novel. So why did you decide to focus on two plots within the novel, first the Codex, and then the second, the terrorist attacks?
Well, you know, they're really interwoven. One exists because of the other. So I never really looked at them as separate plots. They're kind of like two sides of a coin. You know, you have an octopus that's a terrorist organization, and one of the tentacles is to wreak havoc, and thus the terrorist explosions that you have going off. And another one is to extract concessions to get what they want. Mm. And they use the Codex, this ancient biblical document, as leverage.
Mm.
So to me, it's all part of the same story. It's just different tracks that we follow throughout the book.
So what made you focus on, I'm not saying which one, I'm being good, what makes you focus on the Codex as the focal point for this novel? Because that part, I read the first part of it, and then what happens is when I get a book and I really like it, I get eye strain because then I can't put it down. it's bad. Yeah, it's bad. It's just over 400 pages, and I'm sitting there saying, okay, Fran, you're not going to put this down. Your eyes are going to bother you, which they did. So I had to take a break, and then I didn't really want to. So what made you?
Well, I would apologize, but I don't.
No, I know it happens. It doesn't. It hasn't happened too often. Literally, it hasn't. But lately, what can I say? So there are two questions: the significance of the prologue, and what made you decide on the Codex as the focal point of the novel that you interwove into the other part of the novel.
So the whole idea behind this novel started with the Codex, and it arose from a trip that I had taken to the Middle East, and we were in Israel and in the Israel Museum, which was kind of I wanted to go there, but it wasn't the focal point of that day's activities. And we were going to take a tour of the Knesset and see the area which is in Jerusalem. That's the government of Israel, kind of like the capital in the U.S. And so we took the tour of the Knesset and walked two blocks, basically, to the Israel Museum, and we were blown away. It was certainly like nothing that I was expecting, and just an absolutely gorgeous museum, beautifully. The architecture is amazing, and the materials inside were even more so. And one thing that I wanted to see was the Dead Sea Scrolls, because I had missed it. I think as a kid growing up in New York, they did a tour, and selected parts of the Dead Sea Scrolls were on display, and I missed it. I don't remember the circumstances. I don't remember if I was out of town or what the situation was, but that was something that I wanted to see. So during the tour inside, which is their store and in the Shrine of the Book, and which is a structure that was built decades ago to house these scrolls in a special environment. And I see this plaque talking about the mystery surrounding this codex, this ancient biblical document, and that dates back to basically 1000, you know, the 10th century. And I'm looking at this and going, oh my God, this is a great idea for a book. I've got to learn more about it. And when we were exiting the museum, we walked through the gift shop, and I said, I've got to see if they have a book on this. And there was a very small book about it, and I bought it, and I said, someday I'm going to write a book surrounding this. And, you know, so that usually does happen to me. This is not the first time. My book that came out last year, Spectrum, same thing happened, only that was even longer ago. That was in late 1980s. I was in New York visiting family and went someplace that I found out about, never knew about, and said, oh my God, this is incredible. Stored it away for, you know, 20-something years until I wrote Spectrum. You know, it finally, a story idea percolated, and I was ready to go on that. And that's what happened with this, only it wasn't quite as long. It was about 3 years. I said, okay, I got the story. And it involved the codex. It involved this terror plot that you mentioned earlier. And now you asked about the prologue, which is basically takes us back in time to the early 1950s during the original excavation of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I thought this would be a great opportunity to kind of show people what it was like at that time when these monumental documents were being unearthed, and what the excitement was like, and what the impact was when they finally got the first glimpse at these documents. And so it's not a long prologue, but it's very, I think it sets the tone for the entire book. It shows us the impact of this one particular scroll that they find, and the secret that it holds, and the extent to which certain groups are willing to go to protect the secret that it contains.
Well, all I can tell you is that I really didn't know. I knew the book was about this, but when I was walking through the Grand Hyatt and I saw the marquee with your book on it, you know, the whole the book and the display on it, and
right.
I said, I have to read that book.
Yeah.
Seriously, I mean, it didn't do it to too many authors that were there, seriously, but I said, okay, this is a Fran kind of book, and I think I saw it on the internet on Barnes & Noble, and I said, well, maybe the author will be there. I purposely found you, ha, ha, ha. You didn't know that, but now everybody does.
No, I didn't.
I actually did it on purpose, yes. And I was amazed, because just about everyone who I approached sent me a book. And for those of you that haven't read, and I should do this because she was amazing, The Endgame by Catherine Coulter, listen to my review, my interview with her from last week on Tuesday. Yeah. And read the book, because it was fantastic. That would be my, you know, pick for this month. It was absolutely fantastic, and she was amazing. So who are the terrorist groups that you describe in the Lost Codex, and how are they the same, and how are they different?
Well, so the main terrorist group was one that I created, and it grew out of one that really does exist. And the reason behind that was there are certain things that I wanted to do with it relative to my character that I introduced in book two of this series. One thing I didn't mention is that the Lost Codex is book three of the OPSIG Team Black series. And OPSIC is Operation Support Intelligence Group, and they are a covert, quote, black ops group that operates out of the Pentagon, and their job is basically to carry out unsanctioned missions that the U.S. can't divulge and can't even acknowledge is being carried out on our behalf. So this is book three. Book two was Hard Target, and that's where I introduced this terror group. That, again, I did it because I needed to have certain specific characteristics that relate to my character, Uzi, Aaron Uziel, or Uzi. And the easiest way to do that without creating problems with the real terror group that that exists in the Middle East is to create my own, and you know, they're closely related. My fictional one is an offshoot. The people who founded it started in the other one, the real one, and that's often how these groups start. Not always, but often. So you know, they get their teeth cut in Group A, and then they say, hey, you know, they have either a disagreement or they want to hit a different region, or they have certain different ideology that develops over time that's subtly different, and they go off and start their own splinter group, and isn't this great? Bottom line is that's how I created Al-Humat, and Al-Humat is the primary group that is wreaking havoc in the Lost Codex.
This is scary, let me tell you. Now, this is a question that I think many people are curious to know. These young people that actually are brainwashed, that they think they're going to paradise when they're going to be blown to smithereens and air bubbles and dust and nowhere, why do they become jihadists? Why are they brainwashed? And on page 59, you describe it perfectly. Why do they think that this is, you know, their mission in life? And yet once or twice you get a feeling that someone is not doesn't really want to do this, they're afraid. Why do they fall prey to this?
Well, there's a great quote that I also included in the epigram to one of the parts. It's basically divided into four parts, and one of the parts has an epigram that is a quote from one of these misguided individuals that believes he's going to paradise. And, you know, the concept comes from the Quran. And, you know, nearly a third of the Quran talks about the afterlife. And I'm not an expert by any stretch on the Quran. But as I understand it, most of it deals with other features of paradise. This 72 versions thing is a very, very small part of it. But it's become what these Islamic terrorists have zeroed in on. And many of them are young and male, so the thought of 72 women being your sex servants has a certain attraction. It's quite a dream. So, you know, it's enticing. It's almost a form of brainwashing. This is what they want to believe, so they're willing to sacrifice their life to go to the greater plane, the afterlife, which, you know, has a basis in their religion. It's just, as so many other things regarding the extremist elements, it's been perverted into this thing that, you know, certainly was never intended. And they have, you know, cherry-picked what they want and what they see, and they rally around it, and it's obviously become a huge problem. But that's why you have these young people willing to blow themselves up, strap on suicide vests, and walk out into a crowded market of innocent people and blow them up. It's really kind of unfathomable to, you know, the average person who just doesn't think like this and is not radicalized in this way by, you know, by all intents and purposes, a cultish mentality and a mass.
It's scary, and their parents think this is okay because they figure they're going to take care of them. That's what's even scarier, that they don't even just deter them from doing this.
Right. Well, you're right. I mean, that's that's and that's real. I mean, you have
I know it's real
groups. You know, Hamas, even the Palestinian Authority, they pay the families of these martyrs who blow themselves up, and it's again unfathomable for most of us who are not part of that world and that mindset and that thinking. But you know, this is what we are dealing with. It's a form of asymmetric warfare, and that's been the MO of these groups across the world.
Scary, because it's never going to stop. So there are several characters in the book that are really prominent, and that's Vale. You created her before. The one I really like is DeSantos. I like him. And Knox and Nusgiel. So tell us about the main characters of the book and why poor Karen Vale, who is not part of this group, got roped into it, and why did they include her? And her boyfriend got, oh, too bad.
Well, Karen Vale is a character that I created many years ago for the FBI Profiler Karen Vale series, and she's obviously an FBI profiler, and came out of a totally different book that I was writing at the time. This goes back, 20 years or so. And I just needed a character that was not even in my outline for that book. And I just created her. I had been doing research at the time with, at that time, one senior FBI profiler. It eventually became two, but at the time it was just one. And so I had behavioral analysis on my brain. I'd been spending a great deal of time with Agent Safrick, and I had been to the FBI Academy multiple times and the behavioral analysis unit, the profiling unit. So I had that on the brain. And so I created this character and just put her into this chapter, and I was so excited by her. I couldn't write her lines fast enough. I was almost possessed, in a sense, and I just was very excited about her. Now, I ended up removing that chapter from that novel, but I knew that at some point I was going to have to write a novel featuring Karen Vale, and I did write that novel. It's called The Seventh Victim, and it ultimately became book one of that series because my publisher sat me down in New York one day over lunch, and he said, "Alan, when is the next book coming out in the Karen Vale series?" And I kind of chuckled and I said, "Well, I didn't intend Karen Vale to be a series. I don't want to write a series." And that was just a one-off, a standalone. And he said, "Well, you know, the sales reps are very excited about this and they want to know when the next book is coming out." And so, you know, I told him I would sit and think, and if I could figure out ways to keep Karen Vale fresh and to keep me fresh, because I didn't want to get stale and write the same book over and over again and just change the setting, you know. So I said, let me think about it. If I could figure out a way to do this and continue writing very good books, book after book after book, year after year, I'll do it. So I went back to my office. I thought for a week, and I called him up. I said, I figured it out. I'm willing to do this. And so that started the Karen Vale series. Then, during the writing of the Karen Vale series, I realized that I had this other character from the second book I had written called Hector DeSantos. And Hector comes out of The Hunted. And he was in a storyline, along with FBI Director Knox, involving this black ops group that Knox had created years before to address threats to the United States in ways that you know, couldn't be talked about, and just had to get the job done. And you know, they didn't have rules to follow for the most part. So I had this group, I had this character, and you know, DeSantos, and then I had, of course, Knox and a couple of other members of OBSIG. And I when I was writing book three in the Karen Vale series, Velocity, actually it goes back to Crush, which is the second book in the series, because I had to Crush and Velocity are kind of like one big story, and I had to divide them up into two novels. And so I was plotting this whole thing for Velocity while I was writing Crush, and I knew I was going to bring DeSantos into the Karen Vale series. And at that point, it was a very interesting situation, because Karen Vale is an FBI agent. She has a 4,000-page manual of rules and regulations that she has to follow, and ways to conduct herself and her investigations and so on and so forth. It's a very ordered and bureaucratic bureau. And then you have Hector DeSantos, who has none of that. He has basically a mandate to get the job done, and that is an open-ended thing of whatever it takes. You need to get this done. So I thought it would be very interesting to put these two together and see what happens. Now, that sounds odd, because I do outline. I write from an outline. I know where I'm going. Mm-hmm. I know how it's going to end before I start writing the first paragraph of a novel.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't always, you can't ever know what the chemistry is going to be between two characters. And it sounds a little strange, because both characters are coming out of my own mind and brain, right? So, you know, the creative process is like that. You start writing, it takes on a mind of its own, so to speak, and you have these characters talking in your heads, and you know who they are, and it happens. And scenes start to unfold, even though I knew what the scene was going to be, it happens in a way sometimes that I hadn't planned, because the way the two characters are interacting. So Vale and DeSantos have this incredible chemistry. They are very different people from different walks of life, totally different personalities, and yet they get along great. There's this humor that's developed between them, and just tremendous chemistry. And in Hard Target, which was book two of the Obsec Team Black series following The Hunted, years later, actually, I bring in Aaron Uziel, who I introduce him as the main character of Hard Target. And I pair him with Hector DeSantos and his group of operatives and characters from his universe. So FBI Director Knox is there, and Troy Rodman, DeSantos's compadre in OPSIG. And again, same thing happened. I had my outline, but I didn't know how it was going to unfold real chemistry. And Uzi and DeSantos had this great chemistry between themselves. And it literally, the scenes between them wrote themselves. You had Uzi, who basically is a wounded individual. We learn pretty much very early on in Hard Target, within the first couple chapters, that Uzi's endured a major tragedy. His wife and daughter were murdered by a terrorist. And it was a very personal thing that happened. They came after Uzi and took out his wife and daughter in retribution for something. And something that he's had to live with, and he's functioned somewhat professionally well, you know, somewhat well professionally, but you know, emotionally he's deep down a wreck, and he's been existing and functioning because of his work, but not really living. And the events of Hard Target kind of bring it out, and it's a very intense, exciting novel, and it set the table and the tone for The Lost Codex. And now we have Director Knox, the last character you asked about, and he's a very interesting guy because of his background. He was Special Forces in Vietnam. He understands that side of war and geopolitics. He then was a senator who wielded a great deal of power, was on the Senate Foreign Intelligence Committee, chaired it. So he's had his fingers in the power centers of Washington, D.C. for many years. And when he started OBSIG to fill a need He had the contacts and the leverage and the power, therefore, to make things happen. And so he's had pretty much a great deal of autonomy in running this group budgetarily and, you know, in terms of manpower to populate it and training and so on and so forth. And he's feared and respected at the same time. And it's a great dynamic. The people who work for him are fiercely loyal to him. So DeSantis is fiercely loyal. And Uzi doesn't quite, you know, Uzi's kind of brought into this world in Hard Target, and he doesn't really know what the heck he's getting into. he learns. He sees where things go. And by the time we get to the Lost Codex, he's been roped in, as has Karen Vale. And so those are the three main characters, although I added a fourth for the Lost Codex to their group in terms of, you know, primary characters that are carrying most of the action in the story.
Well, my question, which is not on the page but sort of on the page, now there's Robbie. He's her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
For now, anyway.
Right.
For now, anyway. I know, I got that. So I get the feeling that Hector would like to be her boyfriend, that he would like a closer relationship because they get along so well. And she pretty much gets the job done, too. She's not afraid either, which is great, too. So you might want to think about that. And she can't tell him anything. So my next question is, there's a gas explosion. So why did they cover it up? Why don't they tell the truth? And would this really happen in real life?
So this is what starts off the Lost Codex after that prologue that we talked about regarding the Dead Sea Scrolls. So yes, there's an explosion in downtown D.C. and Director Knox is on it immediately. And and he's basically sent OPSIG there to secure the perimeter and the crime scene so that nobody can get in. And as you can imagine, that's a tough thing to do, especially in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
But his decision is to do that and to release information that is a gas main explosion. And the reasons are many, and they're debated and discussed early in the novel as to whether or not it's a good strategy to take. And the feeling is that for a brief period of time, that is the way it's going to be done because they don't know who's behind it. They don't know what's going on. They have suspicions because of some intel that they've got, but they don't know if the intel is reliable. So before they, you know, go before the cameras and saying we've had an attack of some kind in our nation's capital, not that far from the White House and the Capitol, they decide to say it's a gas main explosion and buy time to gather information so that they can face a public and basically say, look, this is what's going on. This is who's behind it. We are on it. We are on top of it. And, don't worry. I mean, if you remember what happened with the DC sniper, it was a horrible situation because people everywhere were afraid to go out. And that kind of mass hysteria was, that was a tough thing for a very large population to deal with, and that was kind of the point of it. That's the idea behind terrorism on its surface, is to terrorize. So, I thought that if you take a situation where you put the first conventional suicide bombing on U.S. soil, that's a pretty heady thing and a very scary thing for an American public that, you know, if you take 9/11 and put it aside because that was really an extraordinary situation in so many ways, but really that was the only attack on American soil. And you know, since Pearl Harbor, I believe. And so, you know, if you start talking about attacks on the homeland again, that would be a really horrendous thing. Does this happen? Yes. I can't give you specific examples where I would say an actual attack has occurred. There are numerous examples where attacks were thwarted and we never know about it, where they come very close and we don't know. So, you know, my job is to take something that's possible, feasible, may have happened, sometimes happens to some extent, and to make it entertaining and you know, tell a story around it that people want to read and find compelling. So, you know, so there's, you know, some validity to it, unfortunately.
I just wonder sometimes if the public knows too much, if it becomes such a point that the media, you know, creates such a hype that it's scary. I mean, there were so many different takes on that bomb, that Russian bomb the other day from the plane. And you wonder just like, what's the truth and what's not. So my next question is, how do you get the Department of Defense and Homeland Security, as you did, do they really work well together, or do they work in opposition to each other, or do they work to see who can get it done and get credit for it?
Well, it used to be before 9/11, that's exactly what happened. For Spectrum, because of the story that I was telling in New York City over the years, it was basically, you know, going back in time and telling Karen Vale's origin story of how she came to be an FBI profiler, and her history, which I talked about in The Seventh Victim and alluded to, is that she was an NYPD cop and then detective. So she was in New York during the years of the 9/11 attacks. And so I researched it very heavily, even though, you know, I was a native New Yorker. I was born and raised there, moved away as a young adult. And so when I saw the attacks unfolding, you know, it was very difficult. And, you know, I'd worked in the towers and, you know, so it was a very personal thing for me. You know, when I was addressing it, actually, Fran, would you remind me what I kind of got off and I got very 9/11 is just a tough topic for me. What was
it is a tough topic for me too. I lost a student,
oh.
And I don't think I'll ever forget. Her sister walked in to school. I was the dean, and the student sister walked in, and I said, "How is Janine?" And she looked at me, and I was hysterical. She said she died in the first hour. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. I just saw she was just in my school the week before, 2 days before, to bring her nephew to school on the 9th on my birthday. And I couldn't. Yeah. So let's go on to the next question.
Go ahead. I can go. But remind me what the question was.
How do these organizations work together? I mean, you look at, you know, Security does one thing and the Department of Defense does something else and the President does something else and the FBI and the CIA. And, you know, I read so many books, you know, where terrorist attacks. How do you get them to understand that we all have the same goal, the same target? We want to get it done. And it doesn't matter who gets credit for it as long as everybody's safe.
Right. Well, purpose in bringing up 9/11 is that that was the 9/11 commission determined that we failed. Our intelligence community, our law enforcement community failed in many ways, and it was largely a failure of communication. One arm didn't communicate with the other arm, so they didn't share intel. And what the FBI knew, the CIA didn't know. What the CIA knew, the FBI didn't know. And if they had put their heads together and said, "Hey, look, this is what we're seeing." Oh yeah, well, this is what we're seeing. Oh crap, you know,
this might not have happened. Yeah,
would have been a different story. So, after that happened, after the commission, they restructured and renamed basically the organization that acts as a clearinghouse of intel and terrorist activities, and that's the National Counterterrorism Center. And I do feature that in the Lost Codex and show how it works now, because obviously that's a vital part of how not just our intelligence agencies and community, but how law enforcement has to respond, because law enforcement, you know, they're the boots on the ground, so to speak, at the front lines of thwarting these attacks before they occur, and then responding when they do occur. So it's a vital part of our government that, you know, really is not talked about much. Everybody knows now about the Department of Homeland Security, obviously FBI, CIA, NSA, but, you know, the National Counterterrorism Center is one that flies under the radar, which is fine. I mean, it's, you know, what it does is not sexy, but it's vital. So, you know, you do have better cooperation. It's not perfect, you know. Stuff still happens, gets through, where one knew something and the other didn't. And, you know, some of it is just the sheer enormity of what needs to be done and trying to manage the data and the personnel. Some of it is you're dealing with people and people make mistakes. And it's unfortunate when there are lives on the line, but it happens. I mean, it's just... as frustrating as it is, I mean, you know, think about how many times throughout the day we deal with people in business and in life, and stuff happens. Well, when that stuff happens at a level where lives are at stake, it's you know, tragic. But that's just a fact. And then you do have still turf wars that go on between agencies, and you know, some of it is the personality of the agency, and some of it is budgetary, believe it or not, because if...
Oh, I do believe that,
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's a reality. You know, if you can show that your agency is being very effective by, you know, fill in the blank, catching this fugitive or making this arrest or taking credit for thwarting this terror attack... people say, oh, man, the XYZ agency is really important. And then when the time comes that Congress has to fund and approve their budgets, and there's a pot, you know, there's a limited pot of how much money there is. So when they start dividing it up, they're fighting with one another as to how it's distributed. And I talk a little bit about that. I think it's in either The Hunted or Hard Target, one of the OPSIG books, about Knox and his ability to, because of his power brokering in D.C. and connections and the stuff, the dirt that he has on people, you know, he has been able to keep his funding levels high, certainly for OPSIG, and, you know, that's made a difference. So that's a whole other part of the equation that people are not aware of, but I've talked with a lot of high-level law enforcement personnel who have alluded to it, and it is what it is. It's, you know.
Well, you have one character that we didn't talk about, and that's the character that nobody wanted to readily accept on the team. That's Fahad. Mm-hmm. How come? I found him very interesting, though.
Yeah, he is. Mahmoud Fahad, El-Fahad, is somebody that I added to the OPSIG team for this novel. And he is very interesting. He's a Palestinian, and he's added to the team because he's Palestinian. And the talents and insight that he can bring to thwarting al-Hamas and the attacks. He understands the mindset of who's behind it, why they're doing what they're doing, how they operate, just, you know, intricacies regarding the organization. You know, his background is in intelligence. And I thought, certainly in terms of the team, it made a tremendous amount of sense relative to the story. But then on a personal level, it made even more sense. because we know, as I mentioned earlier, Uzi's family was murdered by
mm-hmm.
terrorist attack, and we know that Al-Humat was behind it, and Al-Humat is a Palestinian group. Uzi is an American Israeli. So now you introduce a Palestinian character into the team, and this is a team that you need to know the people you're with. You need to trust the people, even more importantly.
Mm-hmm.
You need to trust them. You don't trust them really unless you know them, so it's a circle there. But he doesn't know Fahad. He innately doesn't trust him because of what happened to him. It may not be rational, but you know, he acknowledges, you know, I have to fight through this because we have a job to do, we have a mission, and I'm going to work
mm-hmm.
through it. And the dynamic between the two of them, I thought, was a fascinating part of the Lost Codex, because it influences the mission in ways that they hadn't anticipated. And we're left wondering, too, of what's really going on. And as a writer, it gave me tremendous fodder for action, conflict, character introspection. It was just magical for me. And you know, I won't say what happens throughout
nope.
the book or at the end, but I'm very glad that that I had the idea to do that, because it added a depth to the pages in the story.
It did.
Yeah, thank you.
And it got me wondering, just what is this guy really about?
Exactly.
But before I forget, because I don't want to forget, Thursday I have an interview, a surprise interview, with New York Times bestselling author Shelley Shepherd Gray, A Wedding at Orange Blossom Inn. And I was supposed to interview her last week, but the dentist won. That's all I'll say about that. And the dentist is going to win the entire month of December, so Fran's not going to be on the air until the periodontist gets done with the torture. A week from next week, on Wednesday, this is mind-boggling, award-winning author, international Mike Bond, Killing Maine. And the day after, Brian Friedman tried his hand at West 57th, which is a romance murder novel. Should be very interesting. And I had the honor of just reading his new book, which is coming out in March, Goodbye to the Dead. And if I'm really lucky, because they said they love what I wrote, they might actually take one of my things from my review and quote me on the back cover. Wouldn't that be cool? That would really be I've been quoted before by people, but not by anybody that famous. That would be really cool. And I said, just quote my whole review. I don't care. Some of the books that Fran read this week are Playing with Fire by Tess Gerrinson. You want to read it. It's really, really, really good. Quest Justice by James Patterson, happens to be written by James Patterson himself. I loved it. And one more, Dance Macabre. I don't know why Fran Orenstein is not on the bestseller list, but let me tell you, these stories are scarier than Stephen King, Alfred Hitchcock, or Tales from the Crypt. They are better. She scared the daylights out of me. And I read the book, and I was like, oh, my God, put the lights on because it's too scary. So that's just what's coming up so far. And I would like to say that this is National Alzheimer's Awareness Month. And I would like to dedicate the show to the memory of my mom, who died of Alzheimer's. And I mentioned that I'm going to share with everyone my caregiver tips and kindness tips after the show later on today. I'm going to put them out on my Just Review site so that anyone that wants to copy them can have them, because I really feel that anyone that did what I did for 17 years and took care of a parent with Alzheimer's and other things deserves some help and definitely a big hug, for seriously. Okay, now, why did you choose to let readers hear Karen's innermost thoughts and conflict within herself? Because I thought that was hilarious.
So that's a very interesting story. It goes back to the very first draft I wrote of The Seventh Victim. I wrote the first 75 pages, and I thought it was the best stuff I'd ever written, and it was written in the first person, and I sent it off to my agent, and she calls me up and she says, "Alan, we can't use this." I said, "What do you mean you can't use it? What are you talking about?" She goes, "Well, it's written in the first person, and your first two novels are third person, and you can't switch on your readers like that. It would be too jarring to them." And this was pretty early in my career. This was, probably 2002. I don't even remember. Early in the 2000s. And I hung up the phone, and I was very frustrated, angry. But she was my agent, and, you know, she had her finger on the pulse, and so I had to, you know, really listen to her. And so I sat there staring at the pages, and I, out of desperation, I went in Microsoft's Find and Replace, and I replaced all the I's with she. And, so I did the replace, and I just sat back and I looked at it, not really thinking it was going to, you know, be anything usable. But I realized that I had this unusual viewpoint of third person with a first person sensibility. So I rewrote everything. And there were just so many great lines that were this inner thought that in the first person were usable and were great. And I didn't want to lose them. So I said, well, what if I make them her internal thought, her, you know, internal monologue? So I italicized them, and I sat back and I went, oh my God, this is awesome. This is great. And I wrote the rest of The Seventh Victim that way, and I've written, you know, the rest of the Karen Vail series that way. And people have always commented that they feel like they're in the novel, kind of looking over Karen Vail's shoulder and in her head, because that's, you know, that's what you are. You're experiencing things with her and thinking what she's thinking. And she has some very funny lines, some very funny thoughts. They're things that we think but never say aloud. Sometimes she says them aloud, which creates a bit of a problem. But we're always privy to these inner thoughts, and they could be sarcastic, they could be horrific, they could be what we're feeling at the moment, they could be very funny. And I love it, and readers love it, so it worked. One of those accidental discoveries that happen in life that I wish I could say it was a tremendous brainstorm that I had that resulted in it, but it was an accident really. But I'm happy for it.
Well, that's what made her more real, and that's what made her more endearing, and that's what made me like, okay, I'm going to skip that. I want to read what she has to say, because you actually got to know how she felt about a mission or how she felt about something, rather than guessing. Sometimes it gets in the way of the plot. In this case, it made it better.
Thank
you. Okay, and I have got like two more questions, because we got about 5 more minutes. How did you decide where the story takes place and the different settings?
So the settings are actually really important to me, just in general. The settings are a character in and of themselves. And so in the case of the Lost Codex, I wanted to pick areas that would make sense relative to a terrorist strike. I mean, where do they get the biggest bang for the buck? It would be Washington, D.C., New York City, England. These are places that have tremendous impact on the world and on democracy. And so this is where the beginning, you know, maybe the first half or the first third of the book take place. Paris is, you know, I don't want to go into it, but for obvious reasons, when you start to read it, that made a tremendous amount of sense as to why it has to be there. And then England, there are some very exciting scenes that happen there. And that came more out of my trips to England and, you know, walking and saying this would be a great, great place for this to occur. And then based on things that happened in Karenville number 5, No Way Out, which is set entirely in England, and which DeSantis and Uzi do participate in. It could have easily been an OBSEC team black book, but I felt that it was more Karenville at the time. So that's Karenville number 5. But No Way Out is where kind of things happen in England that set the tone for the characters that Vail, Uzi, and DeSantis and Fahad encounter when they're there. You don't have to have read No Way Out to get that background, but you know it fills it in a little bit. It gives you a little bit more background. So, and then of course the setting of Israel and Gaza and the West Bank. I mean, those are hot spots. When you're talking about biblical documents that were stolen from Israel, you know, you have to have it there. That's part of the mm-hmm. whole story. So, every place, this is an international thriller, and every place that they go is vital to the story and really couldn't have been anywhere else.
All these places I would love to go to, but I'll never get to at the rate I'm going with all the dentist things. Bob, two more questions. Which characters are coming back next? Have we seen the end of the terrorists? What about Robbie and Vail? I like DeSantis better. Is she going to remain with him, or are we going to do something really cool? And what's next?
Wow. Okay. So I'm writing a Karen Vail novel next. It's more in line with a Seventh Victim type story.
I didn't read that one yet.
And there is an Alzheimer's character in there. I didn't want to interrupt when you were saying that, but I had a family member with Alzheimer's, and that's the Seventh Victim. So that kind of storyline with a serial killer where Vail is, tasked with sitting on a task force and trying to figure out what the heck is going on and where he is and so on and so forth. So that's the next one I'm writing. I am going to come back to the OBSEC Team Black series. There were some things that happened in both Hard Target and Lost Codex that I'm going to come back to. It does involve Al-Humat on some level, there's a story thread that was kind of woven between those two novels that I would like to come back to and conclude. So... there are other OBSEC Team Black stories that I have in store that are outlined in various stages that I can't wait to write. And I've got other Karen Vail novels that I want to write, other stories.
Well, when is
that
the next
very...
one coming out, and when am I getting it?
So the next one should be out this time, maybe October of next year. So the Lost Codex just launched a week ago, so...
Mm-hmm.
It's a book a year. So then I'm hoping to finish, well, not hoping, I will be finishing the Karen Vail that I'm writing by the end of this year. It gets handed into my publisher and then it goes through production. So it's a long process, but so it'll be out certainly by this time next year, maybe a little earlier in the year. So that, and then you asked about Robbie. Robbie is a very intriguing character. A lot of people have responded to him since I introduced him in The Seventh Victim, actually. And he's a focal point of what happens in Crush and Velocity. He's in Spectrum. He comes in and out. People want more. They say, can you feature him in a story? So Robbie plays a larger role in the novel that I'm writing now. And I have another. Yeah, he's a character I'm going to come back to at some point in the future because he's a DEA agent now. And I've done a lot of work with DEA and I have a lot of contacts in there and a great story that I want to tell. And Robbie would be a big part of that. And I don't know when, but it's in the future. It's on the burner, and it's outlined. The relationship between Vail and DeSantis is, as I said, just terrific. And I love putting the two of them together. There is sexual tension. You mentioned that, and
I got that one.
You know, yeah. It's, you know, it's not something that I planned. Again, it kind of just happened. It's something I actually introduced in No Way Out. And, you know, in that story, as someone said in England, where they really have to rely on each other. And there was some playful banter and velocity between them. But they play off each other so well. And, you know, they respect one another, even though, you know, there's this tension between them. And that sexual tension, what happens in No Way Out kind of comes to a head, and there's one scene that I wrote in No Way Out. I love that scene, and I could feel the sexual tension while writing it, and I just loved it. I loved it. So is anything going to happen? I don't know. We'll have to see between the two of them. You know.
Well, before we end, do you have to tell everybody where they can find out more about you?
So my website, alanjacobson.com, and it's alanjacobson.com. I'm on Facebook, Alan Jacobson Fans. I'm on Instagram, alan.jacobson, and Twitter, @JacobsonAlan. So I'm all over the place.
Well, you got to follow me because I'm on Instagram. Tilly something or other. And
I will find you.
And I'm on Twitter as Frenelina. My sister used to call me Frenelina. I don't know why she called me Frenelina, but she used to call me a lot of things. But Frenelina was one of them, and I miss her. And if it wasn't for her, and I miss her every single day, I probably wouldn't have reviewed. But before she died, she asked me if I was going to become a fat couch potato. And I weigh about 106 pounds. I weighed 190 at the time. And I said, well, what would you like me to do? Well, I retired from teaching as a reading and writing staff developer and the dean because someone had to take care of mom at home. So she said, why don't you review a book? Yeah, so I did a cookbook, and I don't know how to cook. Seriously. I don't know the first thing of a knob of anything, and I'm lucky I could figure out the thing on the microwave. And I did. I reviewed a book by Martha Chief, Start, Laugh, and Repeat, and Martha hasn't stopped laughing since because it was hilarious what I wrote. Still, it was so ridiculous that I think I've reviewed close to 4,000, maybe 5,000 books since then.
Wow.
Since 2000. Yeah, too many. And I have like 7 bags of books outside that my husband just said, I think you need to get rid of these. You've read them, you know, too many times. And I've got a list of a lot that I'm reading right now. And I read like 6 at one time, which is not a good thing for my eyes, but what the heck. I get them done. But I hope you get to see you at the Thriller Fest again.
I will be there. Yes, I will be there.
Yes, John Land told me he was inviting me. I'm going to hold him to that one. because it will be fun. And I hope at that point you have an advanced copy of your next book so I can read it. And
I think I might, yes, I think we will. We will.
Oh, good, because I like to read things before it comes out. That's the most fun about being a book reviewer is that I never know what I'm going to get. And Brian Friedman's publicist just sent me another book called The Dark, and I'm like, I have 40 books to read, and I picked this up this morning. And go, wait a minute, this one's at the top of my list. This is good. you get tired, and you have the Lost Codex, which is fantastic because at least it's not one of those typical murder books. And I'm going like, oh, this is even better. So I want to thank you so very much. And if you want to share seriously any of your writing tips, articles about anything that you in writing or research, my magazine is coming out. MJ7 is a memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce. So writers, readers, reviewers, anyone that has book reviews sends them to me, and I usually put them in. We're going to have a poetry section this time, Poems from the Heart by Christopher Hart. His mother is the office manager of ENT and Allergy, and Chris is going to be on the front cover because I think a lot of girls are going to buy the magazine when they see him and read his poems. So if you would like to share anything, let me know. MJ7 is going to come out probably at the end of this month, I hope. or beginning of next, and then MJ8 I'm working on, too. We have a speak-out section because Fran's going to speak out about whatever she wants. So if you have anything that you would like to share, I would be thrilled to put it in my magazine.
Okay, very
and
good.
And I will send you a copy so that you could read it and see just how great it is.
Terrific.
So thank you so
well, thank
very
you.
Much. And everybody have a great day, and maybe the sun will shine tomorrow.
Thanks,
thank you,
Fran.
Alan. Have a nice day.
Thank
Bye.
You. You too.